How does your garden grow? Tips for Mary Quite Contrary and for the rest of us too. These are the longest days of the year, the days when your vegetables and flowers are growing so quickly, you can almost see it happening. Especially, of course, if you're watering them. It's been another dry spring, challenging for gardeners who depend on Mother Nature for precipitation. What other challenges are you facing in your garden this season? Woodchucks? Potato beetles? Mysterious maladies that wither your beets? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, it's the return of two of our favorite gardening experts to help out. Bill Kalina from Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens and Pamela Hargest from the UMaine Cooperative Extension. We'll also learn about the new initiative, Plant Something. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Tending to a garden is not a simple matter this time of year. Weeds are encroaching, bugs and critters are everywhere, and some plants just refuse to thrive. Good thing our experts are here to offer advice. Joining me in our studio, Pamela Hargest, a horticulture professional with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension in Cumberland County. And William Kalina is president and CEO of Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you wondering what to do about sad-looking tomato plants? Or do you have a tried and true gardening secret to share? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Well, I think we need to start by talking about the weather. It's been quite dry. Pamela, are you hearing from people who are having challenges because of that?
Yeah, you know, I've heard a little bit on both sides, some people having challenges, but I've also have talked to some farmers who have said this spring has been great because last spring there was a lot of rain and cold weather, and I think the rain really kept people from getting out in the field. So in some ways, having it be dry, being able to, you know, actually work with the soil has been beneficial.
And but, some crops do better in the dry. I mean, tomatoes, this is tomato happy weather, right?
Right, yeah. And finally, we're getting those warm nights. So that's making a big difference for those warm, loving crops. So, so it's, you know, good and bad. Depends on what you're growing.
So, Bill, what at the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, what is loving this spring and what is not really?
Well, it's been a very good spring overall, I think, for the plants. I mean, it was started out a little slow in April, but we had a great spring bloom. Now everything looks very lush. We opened our native butterfly house a couple weeks ago.
Congratulations.
And that's been so fun. I was just in there before I came, and I get in there, I don't want to leave because it's just so great watching all the butterflies flying around. That's been very popular. So,
is that temporary or permanent?
We hope to do some sort of permanent thing, but this is for the next couple of years, and then it'll evolve into a more permanent structure. But people seem to love it, and it's all the native butterflies that you'd see out in the wild, but you know, they're up close and personal. We've got cocoons in there and chrysalises and caterpillars and eggs and all that stuff too. So.
Oh, that's great. Excuse me, Pamela, are we seeing any particular insects or beetles or anything this year in greater supply than other years?
Yeah, we've been getting a lot of questions about cutworms and leaf miners, especially. A lot of people bringing in their plants and asking, what is this? Spinach leaf miners, especially. So this is the time. This is the time when you start seeing eggs on the bottom of leaves, and you can really start scouting for those pests that you might not want in your vegetable garden, at least.
So what would be a telltale sign that you might have one of those?
Well, with leaf miners, they have very small white eggs that are on the bottom of the leaf. And usually it's Swiss chard, spinach, and beets that they attack.
Ah.
And so I've been seeing a lot of that on chard and beets as well. But with cutworms, they actually come out at night. So a lot of times if you're wondering what, you know, sometimes they'll cut around the base of the stem. So if you see your plant completely cut, or if you're not really sure, you're not finding signs of something else, sometimes it's cutworm.
I'm going to go check and see if my Swiss chard had the, what did you call it? Leaf miner?
Leaf miners, yeah. They, it's little white eggs, but then what you'll see is they actually, so they're called leaf miners because they get inside the leaf after they hatch and they'll mine through. So you can't really apply anything to the leaf because they're protected by the leaf. As they chew through.
Right. Am I just wilted? And so I threw them in the compost. But I might want to fish them out of the compost.
That's true.
Yeah. I think I'll do that right after the program.
Yeah.
Thanks about that. Are you seeing anything, Bill, or anything on the roses or anything like that?
Not too bad in the gardens. I mean, the region is, the browntail moths are kind of the big story in the region. I mean, they're just terrible this year for people. And a lot of people I know have got that rash from the browntail moths. And why they're, you know, I think this warm kind of spring is really bad for the fungus that controls them. So that's been a lot of questions about that. We're fortunate we don't really seem to have too much of it at the botanical gardens, but in the community at large, I see it.
Okay, so I'm going to start with an email that came in even before the program. Chris in Standish, voles. The voles are so bad this year. I've put out traps, spread scent deterrents, installed sonic disruptors, put landscape fabric at the bottom of beds, and still the voles are all in my garden. I've planted my very favorite onions this year, and the voles have eaten almost a quarter of them, and I'm pretty sure they ate at least two of my asparagus crowns. Short of getting another cat, the one I have has decided he's retired. What can I do to keep the little monsters out?
Yeah, that's tough. Voles definitely, if the issue with voles is if there's a food source, if there's shelter, and if there's water, there'll definitely be voles there. So, you know, trying to, I think in his case with a garden, if you have a compost pile or if you have a sheltered area, if you have a little shed or somewhere nearby, kind of scouting where they're actually inhabiting the area can be a good way to start because, you know, they'll eat anything pretty much. But if you can disturb where they're living or their habitat, that can be really helpful.
When you say disturb their habitat, find the hole and fill it up with dirt?
Well, it depends. So if they're burrowing in the dirt, it probably means that dirt is sheltered. So if it rains, you know, they can't nest in there because it's exposed to the element. But if there is a shed, they can burrow in the dirt there because then they're being protected from the element there. So just seeing where, like, maybe if it's his garden's close to his house and if there's, like, an ideal spot for a vole to inhabit, then that might be an area to target. If you see holes, you can also try to constantly fill them with water just to work them out of that hole. If you do it once, it might not be enough, but staying on top of it.
Does that work with other critters who make holes as well?
I'm not sure. I think it works really well with voles, but I'm not sure about other critters. They might be too big for it to be effective. But
okay. Bill, and you're smiling. I mean, we get a voles question every time we do this program, and I know you've got them in Booth Bay.
Yeah, they're just one of the native species that's around. And certainly they're food for lots of the, and largely the carnivores around. So they're an important part of the ecosystem, but I still don't like them very much because they eat the plants. But Pamela's right. If you look for where they're hiding out, like a lot of times, like for example, my son lobsters, and he piled all his rope next to the vegetable garden when he hauled his traps, and they just moved right in there in that big rope pile, and so it, you know, moved the rope and had disturbed them all, and the, you know, that scattered all the nests, and maybe I, you know, might have stepped on a few by accident, but. But looking for rock piles, wood piles, compost piles, all those kind of things that where they hide, and trying to keep that stuff away from the garden makes a big difference. And other than that, you know, we cut all the cover down in the wintertime so they have less that they can hide. But this year where it was a lot of snow and they can hide under the snow, they build up. And you probably remember the statistic that if one breeding pair of voles starts having babies – because they breed all year on January 1st, and every one of those survive, there'd be 200,000 voles by the next December 31st.
Oh, I have a feeling that's not what Chris wants to hear.
But that's the idea. So.
We're going to go to Joyce, who's calling from Warren. Hi, Joyce. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer and experts. I'm thinking maybe now that the answer to my problem is voles, or the problem is voles. I planted 5 asparagus plants, and there were a little bit of development on a couple of the crowns. I followed the directions, put them in an 8-inch trench, covered it with 4 inches, and it is not in a wet place, and they never came up. That was 3 weeks ago.
Oh, Joyce, I've had so much trouble trying to establish an asparagus bed. I'm on my third try, and only four little stalks came up this year, so I can completely empathize. Pamela, for Joyce and myself and every other person who dreams of having a lovely asparagus bed, give us some advice.
Yeah, so the first thing is definitely making sure the roots are healthy of the crown that you purchased. So starting off, you know, with good, healthy roots is really important. And actually, the deeper you plant them, the thicker your root, your asparagus shoot will be. So just thinking about how depth makes the difference. But yeah, it sounds like you kind of did the right thing with doing the trench is the easiest way, making sure that the roots are spread out nicely, giving them enough space. But there's always, you know, if they get too wet, that could cause issues to the root system. There's always those elements that you can't quite predict.
The reason I keep trying is because I have read that once you have a bed, it's like having a good rhubarb plant, that it'll last forever, right? But but just establishing one can be tricky.
Yeah, and it can take time. I mean, I wouldn't give up. You know, it's even waiting until the following year because it does take a little while for them to get established. And usually you don't start harvesting the asparagus until like 3 years into the process of growing it. So
would you suggest that Joyce leave that bed alone or try again? Order some new crowns?
Well, I would probably dig up part of the area and just check on the health of the roots, make sure they look good. But otherwise, I think it doesn't hurt to leave it, you know, especially because you know you wouldn't be planting it again until next spring. So you might as well leave it and see if you get a little bit of growth throughout the season.
All right. Well, thank you, Joyce, for your call and good luck. We'll go to Rob calling from Portland. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Yes. Hello. I always appreciate your program. Big question I have is my wife and I, we planted a huge garden, lettuce, basil, et cetera, in a old rowboat, which is up high, about 3 feet. Anyway, I just found last week that I have what looks like a mother groundhog with five little babies, awful cute, but they just completely devastated the entire garden. I've been looking and trying to figure out what to do, and I'm wondering if you have any suggestions. The one that I've read the most about to get them completely gone is the traps, and they have been pretty successful in avoiding the traps I bought.
Yeah, Rob, they are cute. Bill, they're cute, aren't they? But boy, can they eat a lot fast.
I was thinking, Rob, if it's in a rowboat, can't you float the rowboat in a pond? And that way they wouldn't be able to get to it.
I bet they can find a way.
Yeah.
I'll flood the backyard.
Yeah, flood the backyard. Yeah, it's. I mean, it's one of those things that's sort of like voles, you know, trapping or shooting is how people typically get rid of them. But not everybody wants to do that. Certainly, like, you know, I might have told the story before where at one place I lived, I was the only house in the neighborhood without a dog, and all the woodchucks came to my house because there was no dogs there. Dogs certainly, and the scent of dogs, you know, can repel them. Some people say that putting out the, you know, the coyote urine and the fox urine and stuff can help deter them. But I don't have any magic bullet for getting rid of them. If the food's all gone, maybe they'll move on and you can replant because they do sometimes move. But
And if you do trap them, set the trap during the day but take it in at night, because I know people who have caught skunks in their woodchuck trap. So that's not fun.
Yeah, the other thing that was recommended is I put a light under the shed. It's about 4 inches from the ground. Somebody said, one of the advisors had said that they don't like light. So I've had the light on 24 hours a day because I'm going to try and block the shed so they can't get underneath, but I don't want to block them if it's still there. And
yeah.
It sounds like that would work. Are you having luck with that, Rob?
Well, I haven't seen them for a day and a half, but I saw one run across the street last night, so...
They went to the neighbor's house. Okay.
Yeah, right. Well, I like my neighbors.
and you probably know this, but when you put the, you know, hardware cloth is usually what people use, but you know, bury it down pretty deep in the ground and attach it to the shed so they can't dig underneath it.
Ah, good luck, Rob. It's Critter Day, even though it's supposed to be Gardening Day. We'll go to Bob, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I feel like I want to make a comment about some of the other people, and they're pointing out that, you know, there are all these pests and problems. But, you know, what you have to realize is that other species on this planet are trying to make a living and survive, too. It's just us. But I won't go off on that tangent. But you really do have to look at things from in an ecological framework. And, of course, all three of your guests know that. Anyway, here's my question. And I've been wondering about this and fixating on it, obsessed and possessed by it for really 20 years now when I first read a book about compost. My question has to do with composting technique, a basic question. What, in your opinion, is the better option in composting, basic technique, keeping it more or less in layers for a long time, the Rudolf Steiner method, the layer cake method, as it's called sometimes, and hardly ever mixing it, or not until the end or something? That's what a lot of people do, or they just leave it alone and don't do anything with it, of course. Or do you think it's better to have it in a constantly mixed state, you know, like work on it, have it mixed most of the time? Which is better to facilitate better compost and you know, making the whole process more efficient and getting more compost sooner? Now, the problem, so I've been wondering about this, going back and forth, you know, debating within myself which to do. But basically, I'm a fan of the mixing, constantly mixing all the time. Because for one thing, you know, when you see this advertisement about the compost tumbler on late-night TV, there's various versions of them, and they're all terribly expensive. I think it's ridiculous. It's just a barrel that you twirl around. It is probably true that you can get compost a heck of a lot faster by twirling this barrel around.
Sure, Bob. Thanks for calling. You know, we did a program on composting, and the guests on those don't even like the twirling barrels. They feel like it's too rough of a process. Do you all agree?
Yeah, and I think with the barrels, it's for me, compost is great to do on the ground because then you get those worms and insects coming up from that are, you know, in the ground coming up and helping to break down your compost pile. So I just feel like that's a more natural process, and I'm not sure what the guests said or their reasoning, but it seems to me like you might as well use what you have there. And I could see those barrels working better in an urban environment where you want to avoid rats coming into the barrels and you want to optimize on your small space. That's when it would be appropriate. But
so would you have, do either of you have a preferred method of composting, the layer method or mixing?
I mean, what mixing does, a lot of that is it aerates the compost. And oxygen is very important in producing, you know, quality compost. If you have low oxygen, you get this anaerobic decomposition.
And it smells.
Bad. It creates some bad, you know, sulfur compounds that aren't so good. So it also goes a lot faster if you aerate. So aeration, all the commercial composting facilities turn their piles very frequently for that reason. It's more efficient and gives you better compost.
All right. Well, there you go, Bob. And thanks for your call. If you would like to join the conversation, our phone number is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We are talking with expert gardeners, and we will be right back.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Mercy Hospital, celebrating 100 years in Greater Portland, partnering with the community to deliver the next century of care. MercyHospital.org.
In tune Friday night. Friday nights are the time for music. This Friday, new music from River Wireless, Courtney Barnett, Alice Merton, Amanda Shires, and so much more. I'm Sarah Willis. Join me Friday night at 8 here on Maine Public Radio.
I'd like to thank you for the crumbs you left for me. Looking up from the middle class. Maybe I'll leave.
Maine Public is taking part in a national quest by PBS to find America's most beloved book. The Great American Read is a national conversation about reading and the books that have inspired, moved, and shaped us. And we're counting on hearing from listeners like you and others around the country. Maine Public will also determine which book is Maine's favorite book. Many of you have already voted, and the list so far has Charlotte's Web in the lead, then To Kill a Mockingbird, Pride and Prejudice, The Lord of the Rings series, Harry Potter series, and A Prayer for Owen Meany. To cast your vote, and for more information about The Great American Read, just go to mainepublic.org and click on Education.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Summer Gardening Advice. Joining me, Pamela Hargest. She's a horticultural professional with the UMaine Cooperative Extension. Bill Kalina is president and CEO of Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Excuse me, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now, Tom Estabrook, the owner of Estabrook's Garden Center and Nursery in Yarmouth and Kennebunk. He also leads the Plant Something initiative for the Maine Landscape and Nursery Association. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling in.
Good afternoon.
Well, tell us about Plant Something. How? What is it, and how does it help gardeners?
Well, it's an initiative to help promote gardening in the state of Maine, and specifically to promote planting for better health, community, environment, and economy. And Bill Kalina actually is in one of our commercials.
Yeah, people tell me all the time, "Hey, I saw you on TV," and I'm thinking that. Really? That's still running. But has it been successful for you, Tom, that campaign?
It's been wonderful. You know, the campaign really has brought awareness back to the local garden center and bringing folks in as, you know, we are the local experts, you know, in each community. So it really has helped kind of bring the local garden center, which is a, you know, great heartbeat of every community is the garden center. So it's brought a lot of customers in. It's also created a situation where we've given awareness, and the program continues to grow. We're working on programs, hopefully in the near future, that are going to be entering into schools and doing all kinds of other PR things that really will help bring awareness to how great gardening is, you know, from an economic standpoint and also from a health standpoint.
So, Tom, I want to ask you, I hear Plant Something Weekend is coming up June 22nd through 24th. What is Plant Something Weekend?
So Plant Something Weekend is basically a weekend where all the garden centers in the state who are participating are you know, they're running promotions, they're bringing awareness to the community. They're basically a whole host of different things are going on. For instance, at O'Donnell's, they're opening their brand new geothermal greenhouse for tours and are going to be talking about how that is helping the environment. Folks at Robin's Flower Pot, you know, they're having a huge sale, 25% off. At Estabrook's, we're having a sale 20% off, but we're also having food trucks and the radio stations coming, and we're having a kids scavenger hunt. At Plants Unlimited, they're having their 40th anniversary. So they're having a huge, you know, celebration. And, you know, so check plantsomethingmaine.org for all the up-to-date details. People are continuing to post what they're doing and adding. So things are changing constantly. So keep that up to date. And also like us on Facebook. It's a wonderful community. There's also on Facebook now a gardening group for Plant Something. So you can actually talk with other folks in your area and bounce problems, questions, what types of weeds are out there, all the things that are going on in your garden. So it's great for your peers to be able to give you information also.
Terrific. Before we let you go, we know that there are beginners out there. So we want to ask you, if you are a brand new homeowner or moving into a home without much landscaping, what do you recommend? What are some nice no-fail plants for beginners?
Well, certainly, you know, perennials are always a wonderful thing in trees and shrubs. They're very hardy. You know, there's a whole host of things. The biggest thing is visit your local garden center. They know all the things that are going to do well. The biggest thing is the right plant in the right place starts you off for success. So, you know, when visiting your local garden center, they're going to have all the knowledge of what's going to work for your specific location and what is not. So starting out with great advice is the first thing. And your local garden center just does a wonderful job of giving you that knowledge.
Okay, thank you. Tom Estabrook, the owner of Estabrook's Garden Center. He also leads the Plant Something Initiative for the Maine Landscape and Garden Association. We're going to Lisa calling from Portland. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. I have a question about lawns, so not necessarily gardens, but it seems we have a grub infestation. And so our lawn is just absolutely dug up by crows and other little critters looking for the grubs. And when you walk on it, it almost feels like you're stepping onto, like, cake. It just settles underneath your foot. And we've been using Milky Spore for 1.5 seasons. I was just wondering if anybody can speak to a way to control grubs without using chemicals.
Yeah, Lisa, there's several things you can do. I mean, some of it is going to be the health of the grass, and I don't know what your what the soil is like. If before you had grubs, the grass was really healthy, it's the right type of grass. There, of course, there's fescues and rye and bluegrass and that sort of thing. So, picking more of a fescue kind of seed mix, I think, is tougher. I like to, as far as the grass itself, in the spring, rake some compost into the lawn to help build the soil. Make sure that get a soil test. Make sure the pH is right. As far as the grubs themselves, Milky Spore should work. I think in your area, it does take a few applications. I don't remember if you said you put it on once or more than once, but it's took us several years of continually putting it on. There are also parasitic nematodes that you can get. That are specific to the Japanese beetle grubs, which are one of the more common ones to check out. So I think that would be my suggestion, take a multi-pronged approach to it.
Good luck, Lisa, on that. I have an email from Bob. I have probably 100 years worth of porcupine guano under my old barn. True. Some of it is current, but I have access to aged as well. Would this be a good fertilizer for tomatoes, broccoli, kale, basil, and parsley? That's what I grow.
I'm not sure. I mean, you could definitely use something like that. I feel like the newer stuff, you might want to give it some time to break down. But anything that's been, decomposing for a while, for a year, probably fine to use. I have to say, I haven't been asked a question like that before.
That's fun because you get asked a lot of questions.
Yeah.
I smell a marketing opportunity.
Mark writes in the email about moles. I love this is what I love when our audience has advice for other members of the audience. Mark says about moles, we use mineral oil and cayenne pepper. Spoon it into their hole. The mineral oil sticks to their mouth, and the cayenne pepper deters them. You're nodding, Bill. Have you heard about it?
No, but I love these tips. I'm going to try that myself. Mineral.
And I think, Marcia in Blue Hill, you have a tip too, don't you?
I do. For the mole, the groundhog problem, I had heard somewhere and tried it and it worked, that if you could find a hole where the groundhog lives and you put soiled kitty litter in, quite a big one, that it deters them. It makes them go away. I tried it, and they didn't come back.
That's kind of the idea with the coyote. It's sort of like the coyote urine idea. Yeah, sort of a predator smell. So
I like it. Thanks
really
for
clever.
Calling in, Marcia. We'll go to Erica in Fairfield. Hi, Erica. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I just was calling to share that I have the best job in the world. I get to work with school gardens across the state of Maine, doing ag education, nutrition, really helping garden educators understand their resources in terms of teaching gardening and establishing understanding of children's ability to have some control over their own food security. So I just wanted to reach out and share with folks that this is a small nonprofit organization, and we're always looking for people to connect with their local school gardens. And you can find us on msgn.org. You'll see us at the local fairgrounds featuring school garden grown produce in the exhibit hall. And if you're interested in reaching out to support a local school garden, I would encourage you to email me at info@msgn.org or see us on Facebook.
Well, Erica, thanks so much for calling in. Isn't one of the big challenges of school gardens is that the prime season is when school's out?
It absolutely is, and we're actually getting ready to plan a summer garden success tour to tour around and see some of the methods in which school gardens can utilize resources in their community and, you know, community garden clubs or volunteers that can help sustain the program throughout the summer with the maintenance and things, so that way students have something to come back to in the fall.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, and good luck to you. We're going to go to Debbie, who's calling from West Bath. Hi, Debbie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So through the years, I've sort of tackled earwigs, and whether it's potted plants on the porch, or now it seems like they're attacking, you know, the soil where I have bulbs. And as the plants are coming up, all of a sudden the leaves are gone. I've tried putting beer in a cap in the soil. I've tried different things. I'm wondering if there's some non-chemical way that your guests can recommend to me to get rid of earwigs once and for all.
You have two experts giving you face.
The once and for all thing is probably, it definitely works to, to put out rolled up, a roll of newspaper or something like that they can hide in. Paper towel tubes and that sort of thing, and then check them in the morning and then just dump the earwigs into soapy water. That's usually when I have a bad infestation. Sometimes they like cover. They like the moisture during the day, so they like to go places where they can hide from the heat of the sun, and then you won't be able to just to control the population so they don't devastate everything.
Good luck, Debbie. We have John on Facebook. He says, there are a lot of maple trees on my residential property, and maple seedlings are everywhere. What is the best way to control these unwanted seedlings? Pull them up is not a practical solution with so many hundreds of them, and I've heard you cannot simply mow them, nor do I want to poison my yard with pesticide. Suggestions?
You can mow them. The key is that when the seedlings come up, they come up with the cotyledons or the seed leaves, which are these long, narrow leaves, and then out of the top of that comes the first maple leaves. And you have to mow so you go below those cotyledons. You have to mow, because then they
won't. So you have to mow low. You have to have your mower set at a low setting.
Low, because they can't resprout from below the cotyledons. They can resprout from above the cotyledons, and then they'll send out new leaves. But that's the way to do it. The tree to avoid, the Norway maple, which is the one that often has the red leaves, the Crimson King, and those, and they're considered an invasive species. They drop a lot of seedlings. And if it's Norway maples that John has, I would, think if possible, trying to phase some of those out. But the native maples will seed a lot too.
Okay. Melinda on Facebook, what can I do about flea beetles? They're destroying my arugula and kale.
Yeah, it's about that time of the year. Usually in June is when you start to see your leaves starting to be devastated by flea beetles. Well, usually with flea beetles, it's always a preventative measure. If you use row cover ahead of time, you can try to keep them out that way. I know Johnny's also sells this really nice insect netting, too, that you can use that's much more like a mesh texture, and that actually works pretty well. But with flea beetles, sometimes I know it's hard with a small garden, but sometimes if you let them have one part of your garden, you can get away with having other sections that are untouched by them.
So how do you do that? Let them have one part
of
your garden?
It depends on how big the garden is. So, in some cases, they'll just devastate a certain area and then you can, you let it be. But also with flea beetles, sometimes a little soapy water can be helpful, something to deter them from even getting on the plant.
So maybe putting it in a spray bottle and spraying them with soapy water?
Yeah, a spray bottle can work.
Okay. We do have to take another quick break. First, a word about Monday's program. We are going to be talking with Abdi Noor Iftin, whose new memoir chronicles his journey from Somalia to Maine. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden, in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we've been.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Green Lion Gallery in downtown Bath, committed to making original art available to all. shows, classes, and events at greenlionart.com. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com.
Across the region, New Englanders are exploring new industries like biotech in Boston.
We're seeing the convergence of tremendous intellect and a great deal of money.
Or turning kombucha into vodka in Vermont.
I confess we're still tinkering with it. A lot of what we do is just sort of learn by doing because no one's ever done this before.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll explore the innovations that are shaping the future of our region. Please join us.
Next is coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. If you've been away from Maine and you're a classical music fan, we're happy to tell you that our Maine Public Classical over-the-air FM network has expanded. We have stations in Portland, Bangor, Waterville, in western Maine near Fryeburg-Bridgeton, down east in the Bar Harbor region, and our latest signal serves much of the coast from around Rockport to Freeport, broadcasting from the Boothbay, Brunswick region. It's classical music 24/7. More information about Maine Public Classical is online at mainepublic.org.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Gardening in Maine. And we are talking about some Maine ingenuity, too, to tackle some of these problems. Joining me today, Bill Kalina with Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens and Pamela Hargest with the UMaine Cooperative Extension. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Amy, and we started the program talking about leaf miners. We're talking about them again. Is there any way to get rid of leaf miners from spinach? It is a fly that lays the eggs. What do the flies look like?
Yeah, it's... I don't know if I have the best way of describing it. I mean, it looks like an ordinary kind of black fly. But the biggest indicator is because the fly doesn't, other than it laying the eggs, it doesn't really bother the plant. But you're more worried about the larvae. So you want to look under the leaf of your chard and see. They're really small, so you might even need to, you know, look closely. They're small white eggs. And if you see that your chard is already damaged, then, you know, it's pretty likely that it's something like that. There's a lot of that going around. But
do you just pull up the plant then? Do you give up on it?
Well, you basically just cut off the leaves that have been affected. And also, if you're able to catch the eggs, you can just take the eggs off and kind of squish them with your fingers, essentially, with your thumb. They're really small, but they come off pretty easily. There are some other host plants that... the leaf miners will inhabit. So getting rid of some of those plants, like there's lamb's quarters, and there's some other ones that you can look up that they will inhabit. But the big thing, too, is if, you know, they overwinter in the soil. So if the last time that they're going to bury in the soil before the fall is in August. So if you're able to put row cover over the area that may have been affected, then they won't have the opportunity to get into your garden soil. So it's kind of a preventative measure, mid-August. If you cover the area, then they can't, you know, bury in and overwinter there. So you're helping yourself out for next spring.
Okay. Good luck, Amy. And an email from Barbara, and I have a feeling this is going to be related. Living in Cape Elizabeth, we subscribe to a service which takes our food waste in exchange for compost. This year, after laying the compost and mixing it in with our dirt and our raised beds, our spinach and now our chard is developing what looks like rust. Could it be carried in the compost? I have not had this problem before.
That's very likely. Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, I mean, with compost, you try to get it at a certain temperature that you're killing whatever weed seed or anything that might be obviously toxic for human consumption. But there is the chance of something creeping in there and then affecting your plant. But I mean, as long as you practice good, you know, gardening skills and like being on top of taking care of your garden, then you should be able to mitigate that for the future.
So the compost could have carried leaf miner. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying that there's pests and other seeds or larvae that could have been traveling with that compost.
Part of the other reason for turning compost and aerating is you want to get it up to over 130 degrees for a certain amount of time. you know, ideally more like 140, even 150. And that pasteurizes and kills pathogens, insects, weeds, seeds, everything. So the problem is if it's not well turned, the edges don't heat up, and then you can get all kinds of things carrying through.
So a lot of people get compost delivered every year, and so you really don't have any way of knowing if it's been pasteurized then, do you?
You don't, and even, I mean, it's if you get like manure compost from a cattle farmer or a dairy farmer and it hasn't been turned, you know, you can get E. coli through the roof. That's how E. coli gets on spinach and things like that. I'm a huge proponent of compost, but you really need to know that it's been produced well by somebody that knows what they're doing and is turning it to properly pasteurize it. Otherwise, you can bring in all kinds of things. So, I mean, we get ours from a supplier that I've visited. I've seen their operation. I know that they're doing a good job with it. So,
all right. Well, Barbara, good luck to you. I think I've got the same thing. Let's see here. We're going to go to Vicki in North Berwick. Hi, Vicki. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about hydrangeas. I know that they're a later blooming flower in the summer, but I'm only, my bushes, which I've had established for a number of years, are only producing maybe one bloom, if that, per season. And I want to know what I'm doing wrong. I've been cutting them for, I had cut them in the past for floral bouquets, and I was wondering if that was part of the problem.
Are they the blue ones?
Yeah.
And are they producing a lot of leaves and just not a lot of flowers?
A ton of leaves, no flowers, just one. One that comes back every year pretty much in the same spot.
The I don't know what variety you have, but the type that is the most successful are these reblooming hydrangeas like Endless Summer and Twist and Shout and things like that, because the problem with the blue hydrangeas, if the stems get killed in the wintertime, typically they bloom on their old wood. So you need to have a cultivar that blooms on new wood like Endless Summer. That's why that's a popular cultivar. So I don't know which ones you have, but you might go to one of your local garden centers, ask them for one of the newer reblooming hydrangeas. There's a number of them out there, and try one of those.
Good luck, Vicki.
I also have one more comment about the grubs that I use.
Okay.
Okay, so what I do is I have the raccoons and skunks that love the grubs. So I found a great way to do it without chemicals, and that is a motion-activated sprinkler system. So and being that they're nocturnal, this thing just catches them in its sight, and it just squirts them. And
oh, funny.
And they don't bother it. Yep.
Oh, that's great. Thanks for that tip. I have another tip. This is from Steve. A note about porcupine poop. I just said that. I did. A friend of mine fertilized with porcupine manure, and it attracted every porcupine in Waldo County to her garden for a buffet. So thanks for that, Steve. We're going to go to Karen in Brunswick. Hi, Karen. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling because I recently purchased a home in Brunswick, and I inherited a very neglected garden. It looks like it hasn't been touched in several years. I've spent the past few days just kind of digging up weeds and trying to cultivate the soil, but there are a ton of old roots that aren't really connected to anything. So my question is just whether it's necessary to dig those all up before I start planting things. I did buy some bumper soil, which I'm planning on mixing in. I was told that's a good idea, but I don't know if it's if what I'm doing is necessary to actually start a garden this year.
It sounds like there might be tree roots coming out of their trees nearby.
Not really, no. It's mostly just old weeds. It looks like it's been, you know, maybe 5 years since anyone's touched it.
So you're just finding, but usually, you know, by this time of year, if there's roots that were dead, they'd be sort of broken down. But so that's kind of a big thing to just, you know, if it's trees, there's not too much you can do about that. But I think your idea of building up the soil on top of that makes sense. And you may have to find that you have to dig some of the perennials up in the garden and replant them. But you can bring it back. I think you're on the right track with focusing on the soil.
Karen, thanks for your call. We have an email from Betsy. I've heard that Epsom salts are good for vegetables and flowering plants. Is this true? How should they be applied and how often?
Yeah, I've always used Epsom salt as a method for getting better tomato fruits. It definitely helps prevent blossom end rot. But I would imagine that the salts can definitely help your plant receive more nutrients.
How do you use the Epsom salts? Is there a proportion? Do you mix them with water first?
I forget the exact amount that you add, but you can actually kind of mix into the soil at the base of the plant. You don't have to, dissolve it in water. Essentially, once it rains or you water your plant, it'll kind of work its way down. I would be careful about applying it regularly because I would be worried about some other effects of using that. I feel like it can be helpful, especially with fruits. But flowering plants, I haven't heard too much about that. I don't know if you know anything about that, Bill.
Mainly for tomatoes, for blossom end rot. I think if you're, you're applying organic fertilizer, compost, something like that, it's going to have. You don't really need to do that. I mean, people used to do that more when we're using chemical fertilizers, I think. But.
Okay. And we're almost out of time, but I just want to read this email from Gail. One of your listeners asked about using bat guano. I suggest that the person call Maine DEP or the federal EPA to find out when guano can be used. It is considered a toxic substance in the context of guano removal from old buildings. And that's going to be our last word. Thank you both for being here today. Pamela Hargest, a horticulture professional with UMaine Cooperative Extension in Cumberland County, and Bill Kalina, president and CEO of Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.